Impact Leaders, the podcast on impact leaders, influencers, and institutions supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. And this is your host, JP Dahlman. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is safe and healthy. As we continue to be in lockdown in the UK and many other countries, we continue to strive for creating value and bringing high-quality content to you. I believe that during these tough times, it is recommendable that we continue to focus on what is positive and what we can do to improve our lives and the world we live in. My heart and prayers go to all those suffering and all the professionals and staff helping us deal with the situation and everyone affected around the world. And I say that from the bottom of my heart. So here we are recording a new episode, and in today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Seb Below as our guest. Hi, Seb. Welcome.
Hello. Yes, thank you very much for having me.
And thank you. Thank you for being with us today. As I was saying to you before, you know, I have heard so many nice things about you, so it's a real privilege and an honor to have you as our guest today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And I'm sure that people will definitely enjoy it. So as a quick introduction, I will read a quick bio about Seb for you listeners. So Seb Below is a partner and the head of research at Web Asset Management, where he leads the integration of sustainability analysis within the investment process, as well as overseeing engagement activities. Previously, Seb was a head of SRI, Social Responsible Investment Research, at Henderson Global Investors, where he led on the identification and analysis of sustainability themes and company-level corporate responsibility analysis. Prior to Henderson, Seb was the Vice President of Research and Advocacy at Sustainability. He has published several reports on sustainable business and has been a member of numerous corporate advisory boards and awards panels. Seb has 2 degrees in environmental science and technology from the University of East Anglia and Imperial College, and is a chartered environmentalist. Is that good enough?
Yes, that's great. Thank you. Yeah, that's all right.
Thank you. Thank you. And the one comment I was going to make is I was trying to work out your initials in your title before, and the CNEV, I had never seen it. And then I realized I was the chartered environmentalist. So, and you are the first person that I know that has that title.
Yeah, it's something that I'm very proud of. It's part of, I've got it through a group called the Association of Environmental Impact and Assessment, which is the professional body, and they have a chartered status which they award to senior people in industry. And I think it's something that people used to be slightly dismissive of, I think, but I think as environmental issues have become more central in the way that businesses and finance operates, I think people increasingly recognize that it's a valuable kind of accreditation to have.
Indeed, indeed. Well, it's definitely, when I saw it, it caught my eye, and no, it is a first for me and for the podcast, so good to have you here. As it is to our tradition, we first start with the question, what is sustainable and impact investing, Seb, maybe to you personally and perhaps from Web's perspective?
Yeah, I think it's a question that's often asked, and I think perhaps one of the reasons that it's often asked is because the answers aren't always very clear about what it means. And I think that one of the reasons for that is because it's evolved over time. And so it's come to mean slightly different things as time passes. But for us, sustainable and impact investing are two slightly different things, actually. Impact investing is quite clearly defined by an organization called the GIIN, the Global Impact Investing Network. And really that focuses on the intention of the investor. Do you intend to have a positive social and environmental impact through the investment that you're making? Is that the purpose of the investment? And are you attempting to measure that impact? So that's kind of impact investing. You're seeking to have an impact through the investments that you make. Sustainable investing is a bit broader and, you know, links back to this concept of sustainable development and investing in companies that, for us at least, are helping to contribute to more sustainable forms of development over time. So that's the focus for us with sustainable and impact investing.
Excellent. And from, you know, your company's perspective, so I'll read a little bit about Web. So Web is a positive impact investor focused on the opportunities created by the transition to a low carbon and sustainable global economy. So what is it that you as a company see in terms of sustainable investment?
So we are fundamentally, our investment philosophy and belief is that the world is on a transition to a zero carbon and more sustainable economy. We think it's inevitable that the world will have to move that way at one point or another. And we think we're in the early stages of that transition. And what we're trying to do through our investment strategy is give our investors access to the companies that are enabling that transition and benefiting from it as well through listed equities. That's the market that we operate in. So that's really important, that phrasing of companies that enable and benefit from. So the way they do that is by selling products and services that enable the transition to happen, and they benefit from it because as the transition gains momentum, so they will be able to sell more products and services. So their revenue growth is absolutely in lockstep with the world moving to a healthier, cleaner and safer model.
Excellent. As I can see here, you know, so you're well respected, and from your experience, your expertise in innovation in sustainable and impact investing. So you're looking at both. As you mentioned, you focus on a single global equity strategy, which has been developed over the long term and tested across market cycles. So you are about, how long have you been in the business already?
Well, WEB has been, it's a slightly complicated story, but asset management, the listed equity business, was launched in 2009 originally, and then was essentially relaunched in 2012 when myself and some other colleagues joined from Henderson. So the strategy as it currently stands has been around in its current form since 2012.
And this is one particular point there as well, in terms of, you know, since perhaps you joined them before, that you are owner managed partnership is incentivized with kind of taking long term decisions. So, which also some people forget, but it's very important to be able to develop the strategy and also make sure that people are staying with the firm and investing long term, right?
Yeah, it's a really important point. I mean, I think a couple of points there, actually. I mean, the first, just on the long-term point, I mean, these trends that we're investing in, this shift to this transition to a zero-carbon, more sustainable economy, is a multi-decade-long transition. It's not going to happen overnight. And we believe that as investors, the time horizon that we focus on is at least 5 years, and in some cases much longer than that. We expect, you know, individual technologies to grow and go through a life cycle of at least 5 years. So if you're investing for a period that's shorter than that, then you're not really, we don't think, investing in that transition. You're investing in something else. You might be just investing in the value of the stocks moving around. But we think you have to have a relatively long-term perspective if you're really going to be investing in these trends. And then the other point that I wanted to make is just around alignment. We, as managers, myself and my two co-partners, we believe in this. We have our own money invested in our strategy. Over at least half of our liquid wealth, which is always up to a huge amount of money, but that such that it is invested in the strategy alongside our clients. We don't get any short-term bonuses. It's all around the value of our business, and our business is only valuable if we're delivering a good service to our clients. So we're not incentivized around an annual cycle like a lot of fund managers, or even a three-year cycle. We're incentivized over, you know, 10 years and more, the value of our business. So our own alignment is absolutely connected with the performance of our strategy, which, as I said before, is a long-term frame. So for us, at least, it's a much better way of managing a business like this, because you're all aligned around the same kind of time horizon.
Excellent. And it is, in some ways, it is an ESG point because of rewards, right, and pay, which has been, and the financial services has been challenged in so many ways, right? So that's why I thought I'd bring it up.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then on the more specific, so is there only the one fund, or you have more than one fund?
Yeah, we have one strategy. It's sort of a technical point, really, but we have several funds that are all run off the same strategy. So we have a fund that we run for an Australian joint venture partner that is essentially a mirror of our UK fund. It's the same strategy, but it's a separate legal vehicle for the Australian market. So, yeah, but we have one strategy, if that's what the question was, yeah.
Okay, that's perfect. So basically several funds, one strategy. And in terms of the story today, you know, how much are you managing in total? I remember seeing a couple of numbers, but I just want to make sure that people also know.
Yeah, well, it's obviously moving around quite a lot at the moment because of the market reaction to the spread of the coronavirus. And so I think probably at the end of January, we were running around 480 million pounds sterling across the different funds. So in the strategy, I think that's probably more like 400 at the moment. I'm trying to quickly do the numbers. Through between 380 and 400 million. So yeah, that's what's in the strategy at the moment.
Yeah. But still is, you know, you have had quite a growth, because I think I picked up one of your reports in 2018, you had about 256, I think. So it has been a good couple of years in terms of attracting funds.
Yes, it's been an interesting journey for us. I mean, as I said earlier, we arrived from Henderson at the end of 2012. And at that time, the fund had just £25 million in it. And over that, probably from 2012 until 2016, I suppose, around that period. In fact, I know that it was 2016. In June 2016, we were at 100 million. We actually went through 100 million on the day after the Brexit vote in the UK because the pound sterling weakened so much that put the AUM, the assets under management, over 100 million. So it took us 4 years to get to 100 million. And you know, since, I would say, probably the last 2 years, it's gone from 250 up to, you know, 400 million odd. And so we've seen a significant acceleration. And I think that says a lot about the market, really. I mean, our fund has performed. People can see online how the fund has performed, but it's performed, you know, well enough, I would say. But what's really changed is the level of interest in sustainability and impact investing from institutional investors and retail investors as well.
Excellent. So it's interesting to see the growth, which, you know, for some people it may sound like a lot, and then in relative terms, but then also in absolute terms, you know, some people may say, you know, taking you a long time to grow, right? So let's say 400 plus, you know, maybe, you know, 8 years, you know, give or take.
Yeah.
By the way, happy anniversary, because I think you joined in March, right? So it's 8 years.
That's right. Thank you. Yes.
So last month. And that is something that, you know, perhaps I want to talk to you on another question. So I'll park it for a second, but it's this, how do we grow, you know, the firms, and how do we attract more AUM, right? And then I know that we, you know, cannot talk for compliance reasons too much about performance, maybe even fees, etc. But is there anything you can tell about how things have evolved and improved or not improved, you know, in the past years?
Yeah, I'll talk in sort of general terms rather than specific to the fund, because as you say, we're limited for compliance reasons and people can get that information themselves if they want to. But just generally, I mean, over the 8 years now that we've been running this strategy, we actually look back as part of our annual conference that we hold in the summer. And when we look back to 2012, in a way, you can make the case that for most of that period, you know, the world has been at best kind of lukewarm to the topic of sustainability and really addressing issues like climate change. We've had very sporadic support from regulators and policymakers and from the general populace as well. And so strategies like ours have done pretty well, have basically kept up with the market over that period. And then in the last year or so, we've seen a significant acceleration in the level of interest from all parts of society, from regulators and policymakers, from individuals, consumers, citizens. Until recently with coronavirus, there was this huge swelling of appetite and interest in sustainability. And that's caused what we call a bit of an ESG stampede around some particular very high profile companies that are clearly providing some kind of low carbon solution. The most obvious example is Tesla, but there are others as well. And so it's really only in the last year or so that we've really seen interest in companies that are well placed to provide these solutions, getting interest from the wider market. So that's been something that has helped to boost performance in the shorter term.
And then since you mentioned short term, and we did talk about long term, let's put both together. So in what it goes of the year, so let's say if we just look at what the BBC reported a couple of days ago, or a day ago or so, you know, the Dow Jones and the FTSE 100 have fallen more than 20% since the start of the year. And how is that affecting you on the more immediate basis? And how is that affecting, you think, the kind of the sustainable market, you know, this volatility and this kind of negative impact?
Yes, I mean, I think there are a number of things that are going on. I mean, there have been a number of articles in the press also suggesting that ESG, which is a term that we haven't used before, environmental, social and governance funds, which is a broader category, that they have outperformed the general market. That may be true in some cases. I would suggest that the reason that may be true is because of overweight positions that a lot of these funds have in companies like Amazon and Microsoft and Alphabet, which are quite often big positions in ESG funds, because these companies tend not to have too much negative environmental and social impact. But of course, they still have significant impacts, but just less perhaps than oil and gas companies, for example. Mm. But for us, we don't see those companies as providing a solution in a way that I described earlier on. The products that they're selling, in our mind, aren't connected with sustainability. They're not helping to foster sustainability. But that's been part of the reason why I think ESG funds have performed quite well, is because they tend to have overweight positions in those kinds of companies.
I like that. And it's interesting because I always like this part of, you know, highlighting kind of what is what, you know, in the different, sometimes I always refer to shades of sustainable investing, right?
Yes.
Because yeah. And I specifically, I did see a report by HSBC saying that ESG stocks did best in COVID-19 slump, for example. It says climate sustainable investment outperform as pandemic struck, and it's just like what you said. So they performed, and they've got hundreds of companies' stocks from December and then since February, and then they say they outperformed by 7.6%, 7%. But it depends on how you look at the stock and the funds, right?
That's right, that's right, yeah.
What that ESG label means again.
Absolutely, and I think it's quite an important point in a way to be clear about it, because for us and for some other investors that have a particular focus on companies that are providing solutions, so that the products and services they're selling are directly helping to reduce carbon emissions, I don't think you can really include a company like Amazon or Facebook in that definition, because for those businesses, I mean, Amazon's business, while there are potentially benefits associated with deliveries and people not traveling in to buy products in person, business is still all about selling as much stuff as they can.
Yes.
And, you know, Amazon does well when we all buy more stuff on Prime. And that isn't about sustainability. It's about consumerism.
Volume.
And so although they may not be quote unquote bad from a kind of heavy footprint sort of industry sector, they're not a tobacco company, oil and gas company, they're not also good enough, I don't think, in terms of what they're doing to support sustainability. So for us, they aren't investable. As you say, it's really important to kind of understand the differences and where different people are coming from.
Yeah, correct. Then that would be a good time perhaps to talk about kind of identifying and measuring impact. You know, I have been told that you are a person that has been working a lot on that for a long time. And you obviously have, you know, the different reports and methodologies that you create. So what can you tell us about identifying and measuring impact?
Yeah, so as I said earlier on, if you want to label yourself as an impact investor, then you need, at the very least, to be intentional about the way that you invest. You know, when you make an investment, the intention is to have a positive impact. It's not just an accidental side effect. It is the point of the investment. And the second thing is that you are trying to measure what that impact is. And that second piece is difficult, but really important. And it's something that we spent, as you say, a lot of time working on. And it's becoming a bit easier as time goes by, as companies increasingly report this information to us. And essentially what we're trying to do is we're taking that information when companies report it. They will tell you, for example, there's a business called Kingspan, which is an Irish manufacturer of building insulation. Many people will be familiar, I suspect, with their products. And they report annually on how much energy they believe their products have helped save. Mm. It'll be an estimate. They won't know exactly how much, but based on the volume of product that they sell and the performance of that product when it's installed. They can calculate how much energy has been saved. And we take that number, we work out how much of that company we own, and we take the proportionate amount and attribute that energy saved to the fund. We can then take it a bit further by calculating the CO2 emissions that are likely to have been saved as a consequence of the reduction in energy use, and then come up with a carbon avoided figure that's associated with our investment in that company. And we can do that across about 40% of the companies that we own in the strategy. 40% of the companies give us some kind of impact data that we can then use. And we were able to estimate those numbers for a further 20%. So that's how we calculate those impact figures. And what we can also do is that people calculate what is the impact that's associated with their own money that's invested in the fund. So there's a tool on our website called our impact calculator where people can plug in the money that they have and what is the impact that's associated with that investment.
Yes. And I keep having all these different questions that keep popping up in my head, but I mentioned on that one specifically because I went and I actually tested, you know, the tool. So, I mean, I recommend people obviously to go to your website, which I think I mentioned before, but it's webgroup.com. So that's webgroup.com. And what I noticed is that if you need to put a rather sustainable amount of money, you know, let's say to start with $1 million, to have some impact towards the bottom of the different areas, and people cannot see, and I'm sure that you know what I mean, but around the kind of the social side, employment, etc. I just had a question for you around that. So is it a lot easier to have impact around CO2, or what is it that makes that movement kind of easier towards the top and kind of less rather towards the bottom?
Well, you mean in terms of the actual indicators, you feel like you're getting more impact from the environmental themes than you are from the social themes, is that?
Yeah, that's what I thought, you know, unless please correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, it's probably partly to do with, honestly, the quality of data that we get from the companies. So we get more data and higher quality data from companies that are focused on environmental themes and particularly carbon emissions. We also have a more significant proportion of the fund, I think, devoted to environmental themes around carbon in particular. There's one indicator that we have around education, for example, and that's all linked to one investment. So it's just one company.
I see.
So it may be to also to do with the proportion of the fund that's invested in the different themes.
I understand. And then just to, for people's benefits, basically what I was referring to is you have at the top clean energy, resource efficiency, water management in terms of distributing of water by liters and treating of wastewater. And then I think you have recycling, so environmental services, health in terms of people receiving healthcare, people well-being, and then education. So yes, okay, I understand. I thought I just mentioned that because if it came to my mind, I thought if somebody comes to the calculator, they may actually think about the same question.
Yes, no, that's a fair point.
And then you obviously have, and I recommend as well, you have the reports, right? So you have two ones I want to point people to. One, which is the methodology, so the impact methodology, which is a document where it explains everything that we're talking about. And there is some of the parts there around how do you link it also to SDGs, how do you also look at the categories of impact, you know, degenerative, transitioning, mitigating, a breakthrough. So you're looking at various areas and in various different ways. You know, you're mapping the company quality and the impact. So you have developed quite a few kind of angles and parts to it. I'm assuming that this methodology is an evolution, right? So since 2012 when you started. But please, if you can tell us just a little bit of how it all came about, you know, how has it evolved, you know, how is it or how is for you or for other companies to try to develop the same?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that we did really when we started the strategy, so we didn't necessarily report this information, but it's certainly a step that you have to go through, is to work out what proportion of a company's activity or their revenues are linked with the themes that you're interested in. So for us, we have 9 investment themes, 5 environmental around the areas that you described, cleaner energy, water, sustainable transport, and so on, and then 4 social themes. And you know, the point of the strategy is to invest in companies that are providing these positive impact products and services. So we're trying to maximize the exposure that we can have to the themes. But sometimes you get a company that is a conglomerate and has different businesses, and not 100% of their activity will be focused on the themes. But that's the first step. And that's, again, something which is getting a lot of support from things like the UN Sustainable Development Goals, where companies can report what proportion of their revenues are linked to the different goals. And also, most recently, with the EU taxonomy that's been developed at the moment, that does a similar thing in terms of categorizing, you know, according to the European Commission, what activities should be considered to be quote unquote green activities. So the first step is for companies to report what proportion of revenues they have coming from these different areas. And then we can use that to decide which companies should be investable for us. So that's the first piece. But the second piece is then to say, well, it's great that you have this exposure, but what is the actual impact that you're having through the products that you're selling? So, you know, Kingspan, going back to that example, Kingspan, which is an Irish company that makes building insulation products, they actually report an absolute number every year of the amount of energy that they believe their products have saved. And so for us, what we've done in this next phase of our impact reporting is to actually take that number and attribute a proportion to the fund based on the proportion of that company that we own. We've also gone actually a step further to try and translate that back into carbon emissions. So they report an electricity saved or an energy saved number. And then based on where they sell their products, which is data that we have, we can then work out, well, what does that mean in terms of carbon emissions? That's the piece that sits behind our impact calculator, where we're able to actually report on the absolute levels of positive impact that are associated with an investment in our fund.
Excellent. And then in terms of, you know, how, you know, sometimes I always like to share best practices for those that haven't yet, those funds, you know, that all fund managers that haven't transitioned into sustainable impact investing and creating methodologies to measure impact, you know, within their investment processes. Is there any kind of tips or, you know, sometimes I call them nuggets that you can share with them to say, you know, how that makes it easier for them to create something?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's obviously the practical questions of how you take the numbers from a company like Kingspan or others, and then how you translate that into units that you can use for the fund. And we've published our methodology and we'll be publishing an updated version this year. But that's kind of a sort of technical process. In a way, the most important thing in all of this is a philosophical one, actually, where as a fund manager, you genuinely believe that by investing in companies that have these positive impacts, that you're going to be investing in companies that are will be successful investments. And it's a really important point that, you know, the companies that we invest in, every time they increase their sales, they're increasing their positive impact. It's coming from the products that they sell. And so there's a very sort of elegant alignment between the positive impacts of the company and increases in sales, revenues,
growth,
margins, growth, and so on. And it's really important to have that. If you don't have that, you're always going to be conflicted in some way. If you don't have that underpinning philosophical view on how you make good financial investment decisions, and that part of that is linked to the positive impact. And that's really the core or the foundation on which we're able to build our investment process. If you don't have it, then it makes it much more complex to try and navigate these dynamics, which may sometimes be running in opposition to one another.
Excellent. And again, I insist, you know, people should go to the website and to check your methodology. And then you also have your report, which is, you know, I think I picked up on the 2018 one, Prosperity with Purpose, which I think gives a bit of an overall view of the impact of your company slash, you know, strategy altogether, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Perfect. One more thing I wanted to check on, you know, the holistic view and everything that you do. I picked up on your website as well, you have this tab called engagement case studies. So mm-hmm. you do engage, it says, you know, you engage with businesses in your portfolio in order to understand them better and encourage a more progressive approach to environmental, social and governance issues, right? And then I also noticed that kind of over like 60% of it is around governance, right? I think you have as brackets, not disclosure. Can you just expand a little bit more about that? Because I picked it up as something interesting, but
yeah, I mean, so I mean, we do a lot of engagement with our companies. We own about 50 companies in the portfolio, and we have an investment team of 4 people. So we're relatively concentrated, and we do have a reasonable level of resource to work with companies, but it's not bottomless. So we are somewhat constrained in terms of the amount of engagement work that we can do. And our focus typically tends to be around, I mean, there are 2-3 sources of engagement, but the main one is around the annual general meeting and our voting at company meetings. When we vote against a company or the management of a company, we will write to them and explain why we voted against. And quite often, those topics are more traditional governance issues around independence of directors or the amount that they pay the CEO, the remuneration of the CEO, those kinds of issues, which are a bit sort of more core governance issues. And because every single company that we own has an AGM every year, that drives quite a lot of our engagement. The other stuff actually has increased in the last year. So when we publish our impact report this year, you'll see an increase in the amount of engagement we're doing around environmental and social issues. And that's more proactive engagement that's driven by us going out to companies and saying, particularly around, for example, gender diversity at board level, we've done a lot of work to try and encourage companies that we own to appoint more female board directors. Also, obviously, around climate change as well, and seeking quite aggressive carbon reduction targets. And we've done a lot of engagement around that. But that tends to be more proactive engagement work that we drive ourselves, independent of a company general meeting.
Great. And I know that it's not as straightforward, you know, because it varies company to company, but you said you hold about, you know, I was talking about 50 companies. Is that kind of an average of, you know, how much you normally hold in relative terms to the total? Are you a 1% owner? Are you a 10% owner? Or is it too wide to say?
Well, of the companies, so yeah. So within our fund, we own a typical position size might be 2% of the fund for 50 companies, and on average 2%. Of the companies, what does Web represent of the company's shareholders? It tends to be much less than that. I think the largest we own is maybe a 1% position size. For our smallest company, then, we would be about maybe 1%. But yeah, I think on average, it's more like, 0.05 or something. So these are large companies, and we may have 8 million pounds stake in them, but 8 million pounds in the context of a $5 billion business is a small percentage.
And the main reason, I think I never asked this question this way before, and it was just because it's just to stress that, you know, even if you hold the 0.5%, it just gives you the opportunity to have that conversation. And then, you know, they are open to having that conversation. And then the question is, you know, how much do they listen?
Yeah. I mean, it's fair enough. It's clearly, if you have 5%, then the access that you get is going to be quicker and higher up than if you only own, you know, 0.5 or even 0.05%. But we get pretty good access to companies, certainly to the investor relations team, and then typically beyond that as well, if we're asking questions that require someone else within the organization with expertise, then they're generally made available to speak to us. I think the key thing often is in framing your questions or your requests in a way that align with the management's own, you know, own outlook and sort of incentives. So even these ESG issues that we talk about, we frame them from a business point of view. So yes, when we're talking to a company about setting a carbon target, we talk about that being a strategically valuable decision, you know, getting them in front of their clients, positioning themselves as leaders, driving cost reductions. You know, those are the things that you have to stress rather than, you know, because it's good for the planet. Yeah. And then you're more likely to get engagement with the management team if you frame it around the business case for taking these things.
Yes. And I always say that, you know, you have to be commercial, right? So ultimately, you know, that's how you are going to make the business sustainable. And then that translation, I always talk about that translating, you know, these views and this edge that you can help them create, it makes them more commercial. So it creates that commercial conversation, right? Strategic, but commercial, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, your final point, JP, was whether they listen. And I mean, we do report on the proportion of our engagement that we think is successful, those that we think are partially successful, and those that we think are unsuccessful. And, you know, generally, off the top of my head, I think it's around 40% that are unsuccessful, where we don't actually get the company to change their view. But it does mean that 60% are either successful or partially successful. Partially successful means where, you know, they've listened to what we have to say and they've taken it on board. They may not have changed their mind yet, but it's a conversation that's been started. That's kind of what we think of as partially successful. Unsuccessful is when they've just said, you know, thank you and no. It's clearly unsuccessful. So we try and calibrate the engagement and categorize it into one of those three buckets.
Yeah. And that's really nice as well in your website that you have the examples and you actually put the tab, you know, the name of the company and if it was partially successful or not. So that's really good. It's interesting as well, as I look at the website, you know, maybe I should, but there are no brands that, you know, everyone would recognize that easily. So it just made me think, like, how do you normally, you know, source and decide which companies you to invest in, you know, but that's part of your IP and your equity analyst teams, I guess, coming up with the
idea. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we've built up a database of about 1,000 companies over the years that we know fit in our investment themes so that we know they are investable. They are exposed to our 9 investment themes. So that's taken a long time to build that database up. And it's constantly evolving. I mean, we get new ideas from all sorts of sources, actually, from conferences we go to, from sell side brokers, from publications, you know, it can be anything really. And so we then put them into that database and then we can use that database as a source of ideas when we want to move away from a particular company. We have a ready set of ideas that we can move into.
Yeah, and that's a point that I still find fascinating, which is, you know, with big data and algorithms and AI and whatever you want to talk about, you know, still there is a lot of added value, you know, by humans finding these opportunities, putting a thesis together, having the interaction and engagement with, you know, person to person, which I always, you know, highlight because it's something that we don't seem to be able to get away from, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's particularly in this area where things are changing so quickly and new technologies are evolving so quickly, it's very difficult to do this, I think, with just a kind of passive structure that requires you to know what sector and subsector a company is in. I mean, we invest in some semiconductor businesses because we know that the products that they make are particularly valuable in, you know, electric vehicles or in the Internet of Things or other applications that we know have major environmental or resource efficiency benefits. But from a sector point of view, they just look like semiconductor businesses. And you really have to analyze them to work out which are the ones that really have the applications that feed into these low carbon sectors. I don't think you can do that yet. I mean, perhaps there will be a time where you can, but you can't do that yet from a passive point of view.
Agree. And I know that I didn't mention numbers before, you know, we don't look at specific numbers of performance, etc. But I was thinking about the question. So everything that you do, the methodology, how you approach, you know, how does it affect your alpha and your returns? Have you seen, and effectively your performance over time, have you seen an increase? You know, it's been steady across, you know, the 10 years or the 8 years?
I mean, there are so many things that go into performance. You know, for example, we don't own, as you would expect, we don't own any oil and gas companies or any of the oil field services businesses that work with the big extraction and production companies. And that's been a tremendous benefit to the fund over the last 10 years, not owning oil companies, oil and gas companies, to the tune of, I think it's 4 or 5% have been added to the performance of the fund by not owning those sectors. But we also don't own, I think, as we mentioned before, we don't own the big tech companies either, like Amazon and Google, because we don't think they are providing a solution to a sustainability challenge. And over the last 2 years, that's been a real headwind for the fund because those companies have done so well. So there's so many things that go into the performance of a fund, and it's difficult to pull out a particular sort of sustainability driver. What we do have, though, is something called the thematic selection effect, which is essentially the benefit of only focusing on those 9 investment themes and not owning all the other sectors that are in the market. And over the 10 years of our strategy, that has been a positive contributor in, I think, 6 or 7 of the years. So we do know that over time, having that thematic exposure, and that's not unique to Web either, that would be true of other funds, has been a positive contributor to performance. So that's one data point. And perhaps just quickly on another one, which I think is interesting, is we know that the revenue growth to our investment themes is significantly higher than to the market as a whole. So companies that are in our environmental themes, like, you know, resource efficiency businesses or sustainable transport companies, they are growing on average much more quickly than the market as a whole, which is, you know, I think, although that's, you know, you can have good revenue growth, but no profit growth. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to make lots of money, but it means that that part of the market is growing more quickly. And, you know, thank goodness that is the case, because we clearly need these companies to be growing quicker than the rest of the market.
Yes. Yeah, I could go on and on about this part. I think it's very much interesting in so many ways, right? But we'll park it there for now. Maybe for our next podcast, we'll talk a bit more on some of the examples, if you agree. So I'll move swiftly to ask you a little bit about your clients and the investors that come to you. I was thinking about as well, you know, you told me the story of how you went from an initial about 25 million, you know, how then you went to 100 just around Brexit time, and then how quickly it seems to double and double again. So what type of clients come to you, and what has been the change that you notice in the past years?
Well, I think there's always been a relatively small core group of investors who have wanted to invest ethically originally and now sustainably. People who, and I'd include myself in this group as well, who just don't want to invest in companies that are polluting the planet or harming human rights or whatever it is, you know, sort of ethical approach to investment. And they've been, depending on, you know, which data you look at, I mean, it's a small single-digit percentage of investors who invest that way, still many billions of pounds, but a small group. And that has grown as a source of investors in our fund, but it's always been there to some degree. And the real growth has come, I think, from two other sources. There's a group of investors who aren't necessarily ethically motivated, but believe that this is the way the world is going. Mm-hmm. And believe that this is the way that you should invest if you want to make money over the long run. And the fact that it's into companies that are doing quote-unquote good things is a nice thing, but it's not the main reason that they invest that way. So I think that's a relatively new addition, probably over the last, I don't know, 3-4 years, that group has become more significant. And then the final group is a different category of very large institutional investors who, you know, have much stricter governance around how they invest. And for a long time, it was kind of understood that they couldn't really invest in our kinds of products because it was seen as being not a value maximizing approach to investment. Now, that's changed a lot in the last few years. And increasingly, these large institutional investors are kind of required to at least think about ESG issues, but they're also under a lot of pressure from their own beneficiaries to invest in a more responsible way. And so in the last couple of years, we've certainly seen the really big pension funds and insurance companies and large asset owners begin to move money in this direction as well.
Perfect. And then just to recap in terms of, you know, percentage-wise today, so it's mainly a family office or is it now more institutional investors that come to you?
For us, it's still mainly wealth managers, you know, at least in the UK. I mean, we do have investors outside the UK as well, but in the UK context, it's, you know, still a big proportion is the traditional ethical investor or the investor who wants to align, invest in a way that's aligned with their values. I'd hesitate to put a percentage on it, but I would say still the majority are like that. And we're now seeing a very rapid increase in these other sources of funds, but they're still a smaller part of the total today.
Okay. And then I just always try to put myself, if I am an investor and I want to come and talk to you, what normally is the reason why they say they come to you? Is it kind of the active investment part? Is it the methodology? Is it because of you? You know, just to also think, you know, if I'm an investor, you know, what is it that you do differently?
Yeah, I think There's different reasons for different people. I mean, we have a long track record. As you know, we've been doing this for as long as pretty much anybody. The original fund was set up in 2005, so it's been going for 15 years. I think a big part of it is we believe in it. You know, we're not jumping on a bandwagon. You know, we've been doing this when this was really not popular, when no one else was doing it. We started up. We were very much considered to be the kind of the weirdos in the room when we were working in larger financial institutions. And we were heavily invested in our fund ourselves. All of the partners have the majority of our own money invested in the fund. You know, we believe in it. And I think that's important for our investors to see that integrity and commitment. You know, the financial sector is not beloved of people. You know, it's not trusted very much. And I think they like to they invest in funds with people that they think they can trust. And I hope they think they can trust us. And then also things like the fact that we are very transparent about what we do. There's an awful lot of information on the website, and that also helps to underpin that trust. If they can see what we own, why we own it, then that's really important to people. And then finally, we're an independent business, so we're not owned by another larger financial institution. We are just this one strategy. It's all we do. And I think, again, that helps people. I think not everyone, but a lot of people like that sense of having a connection with an independent business.
Yes. But as we see more activity on this area, I'm assuming that you must get approached by larger institutions, you know, trying to either get a percent stake in your company or try to bring you into their companies, right?
We do get quite a lot of approaches, yeah. But we've not been interested in anything so far. I mean, not to say that might never happen, but for the moment at least, we're very happy being independent and don't really see the need to become part of a bigger institution.
Right. And then obviously it's more than clear that your website is really good, because I think that in this episode is the episode that I have referred to a website so many times. I think it's very simple, but very practical, you know, way to find all the information. So I must agree, it's very transparent. You have everything there. So
great. Thank you.
Yeah. And now talking about the future, what do you think are the kind of the challenges and opportunities, you know, for a bit of the market, the business and for web, and especially with all that happened right now as well, right?
Yeah. You know, it's obviously, I mean, web's future is very much linked, I think, with whether financial markets, at least, and investors, you know, seek to address these challenges around climate change and wider environmental and social issues. I mean, if we stick with climate change as a kind of example of those, I think it was Prince Charles said about 12 months ago or 8 months ago, maybe, that we had 18 months to really shift our approach to climate change aggressively and begin to put in place the foundations that we need to get us into a trajectory onto the zero carbon economy. And while the short-term impacts of coronavirus have obviously been to clear our skies, and I'm sure you've seen some of these clips of data around how much the coronavirus has caused carbon emissions to fall. But, you know, until we actually put in place the structures and policies that ensure that when the economy bounces back, it does so in a greener way, you know, then this short-term blip is just a blip. And it's not clear whether coronavirus will help accelerate that change or whether it'll slow it down. I think there are good arguments both ways, but, you know, it's not clear exactly how that's going to play out. But, you know, in the meantime, people's interest hasn't gone away. Actually, people are still, just from our own experience, people are still investing in our fund. We haven't seen any major withdrawals of money. We've continued to take new money in. So I think we will come through this period with coronavirus. I think life will have changed in many ways, but we will return to these long-term issues that we need to deal with, like climate change. And, you know, I hope that we do that in a way which sees the deployment of these technologies that the companies that we invest in are producing, and that the free market is or the private sector at least, is a big engine for change towards the zero carbon economy.
Yes, I agree. It's interesting, like a picture that I saw, I think it was like in one of the social media sites, that was showing a little bit of the inverted bell graph for the virus, but then the massive inverted bell graph that we have for climate change still, which is there, we're waiting for us as we come out of this. So I want to remain positive that we will really to continue with the momentum, you know, after this. So let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And then you did mention briefly the EU green taxonomy and the kind of the investment implications, right? So how much you think that is going to be, obviously we have the DCFD and we have all these things that were happening just before the latest event. So how much do you think that that is going to be the stick or the tool that we will have to use to push companies and people to a sustainable future?
Well, I think it's, I have some concerns about the taxonomy, but I think at a very high level, without wanting to get into the detail, I think the fact that it's being done and the fact that the European Commission has got this much broader sustainable finance package is really important. You know, it's an extremely strong signal to the market that this is where the European economy is going. Of course, the European economy is, although it's the largest economy, it isn't one that's growing particularly quickly. So it is important that we get other parts of the world to sign on as well to some of these things. So I think that the taxonomy, you know, is definitely a welcome signal. And I think over time it'll probably evolve, because I'm not sure that the way it's currently structured is going to be practicable. But as I say, it's a very welcome high level signal in terms of the direction and the trajectory that the European economy is going to be on.
Okay. And then one last question on this theme is about, so how do we, what else do we need to further scale and grow funds like yours, or another way to put it, transition more capital into sustainable impact investing? What needs to change, or what can we do?
Well, I think obviously we can all take measures as individuals, and that certainly adds up to a lot when a lot of individuals move their money that way. I think we can seek to engage other actors within the financial system. So the banks, the insurance companies, you know, our pension funds, and encourage them to also actively support the transition as well. I think, you know, in my view, a lot of the technologies that are coming through are actually just, they're better technologies. I mean, if you're looking at the cheapest source of power, new power generation today, then it's wind and solar and pretty much everywhere in the world now. I mean, just looking at the charts today of the UK power grid, nearly 60%, I think it's just 57%, some of that is now coming from wind and solar today in the UK. I mean, it's extraordinary. Battery electric vehicles, while they're still more expensive today, particularly with the oil price where it is, over the next 5-6 years, they will become the cheapest way of getting around. They're so much more efficient than internal combustion engines. So a lot of this technology, you know, is just better technology, and it will eventually dominate in the market, but we don't have time for it just to eventually dominate. We need it to be deployed really quickly. And we do need governments and policymakers to do that. So as individuals, we need to ensure that our elected representatives push this agenda very aggressively. It's not going to be enough for the market to do it on its own. It'll need to be accelerated, and that does need policy support still.
Yes. I remember you tweeted something about this, about the time where all the virus kicked in. And it was a bit of good news within the bad news of renewable energy overpassed kind of fossil fuel energy. But so that's a good point. So I do recommend people to go and check down your Twitter account.
Yeah, thinking that, I mean, I just think it bears, you know, when I was a student studying environmental science at university, we were told that you couldn't have renewables on a grid of more than 5%, maybe 10% at most, and the grid couldn't take it. You know, I'm looking at my chart now, we have the largest source of renewable power on the grid today is wind at 29%, then followed by solar at 23%, and then it's gas at 17%. I mean, it's a source of, you know, still real joy for me that that's the case, having been told that it was impossible when I was a student. I think it's remarkable.
Yeah. And I was having a call with somebody about this without digressing too much. It is as a human condition to normally say that something is just impossible, right? The first reaction, and we have proven again and again that we always find a way, and, you know, whatever we project that actually is, you know, 10 times better in some cases.
Yeah.
The other point I was going to mention was around, you know, the help that we need from governments, you know, policies, etc. Sometimes, you know, I think people find it hard to understand what that means. And I picked up on LinkedIn and I share, I think, this post. There was a note on the FT about this Nordic investor that allocated about 600 million of his personal wealth to move from fossil fuels to renewables. And it's interesting because he was saying how he got the timing wrong. And then he went through about 2 or 3 examples of, you know, where he put his, you know, his millions. And I remember that at least two of them were affected by government policies, where the government started to subsidize petrol, for example, or in the other one, they stopped the imports of wood from Canada to the US. So then, you know, his renewable, you know, wood business, you know, didn't work, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember that it really hit me how, as a business, you know, you can basically have the government against you if they don't support the right policies, right, and the right incentives.
Yeah.
That we have seen that again and again. I think one example was in the US, another example was in Brazil, where he invested in gas. And just to give a real life example, I recommend people to check that out as well.
Yeah, I mean, the policy is a real double-edged sword. You know, it's one of the things with solar investing 5 or 6 years ago was the real focus was just on what the German environment minister was going to say, because there was so much subsidy being used to support the solar industry in Germany, and Germany was by far the largest solar industry anywhere in the world. So what the environment minister said day by day really mattered. You know, we've got well beyond that now. And what I mean more generally is, you know, like I said, a lot of the companies that we invest in, they're growing, you know, quickly today, but it's not quick enough. So its policy is really needed to supercharge and accelerate the process. I think it's a slightly different tone to where it was 6 or 7 years ago, where if you didn't have government subsidy, then these industries would collapse.
Yes.
Now we're talking about industries which are viable, profitable, but we just need them to grow more quickly. And so it's, the risk isn't quite the same as what it used to be. I'm not saying it's gone away completely, but it's, we're not dependent on subsidy anymore. What we need is, you know, new tools to help accelerate the deployment of insulation into buildings or electric vehicle charging infrastructure, or, you know, those kinds of things.
Yes, perfect. So as we're coming towards the end of the episode, I just wanted to make sure that I ask you just one or two questions, you know, about you. So I wanted to ask you, what drove you, you know, to move into this area? I think at one point you mentioned how you have potentially a personal change. Is there some one event or one person or something that made you become more aware, or was just it?
Yeah, I've always been concerned about the environment. From originally, it was more conservation sort of issue around the natural world. You know, as far as I can remember, really, that's always been part of who I am. I think I was very lucky to study. I went and studied environmental science as my first degree at the University of East Anglia in Norwich, and we had a couple of very inspirational lecturers there who really energized us, I think.
This is a time to mention one of the names, if you want, by the way.
There's a guy called Professor Tim O'Riordan, who is a very well-known environmental professor, you know, back in the 90s, and was an advisor to Prince Charles and others, and he was an inspirational man, and I think certainly inspired me to see how I could pursue a career in the environment. Originally, I worked actually at the European Commission in Brussels on environmental policy, but decided that actually I wanted to be in, I thought, business, and then ultimately finance was a key driver of change rather than necessarily policy on its own. So that's why I've ended up where I am now.
Interesting. And then one before the last question is, you know, this is called Impact Leaders, you know, our podcast. And we always ask, what is a leader for you? What advice would you give, you know, to people that want to drive an impact in the world?
Well, I think I've still got so many years left, I think, is in my career. And I've been fortunate in being able to get to where I am today. But I think one of the things I often appreciate most is that I really enjoyed working with people who have a sense of mission, where that mission is about something, you know, bigger than them. It's not just about the size of their paycheck or their status or anything. It's actually, you know, they actually care about something that's bigger than them. And it's been a real privilege working with people who have that real sense of mission around environmental issues. And I can't really imagine not having that or not being surrounded by people like that. And I hope as this part of our world grows, the sort of impact investment world, as inevitably it grows and brings in more people, I hope it doesn't lose that sense of mission and trying to deliver change, because I think it would be poorer without that. But so my advice to people who are embarking on this is to try and hold on to that sense of mission as you move through your careers, because ultimately that's what's been most fulfilling, I think, so far for me anyway.
Brilliant. Fantastic. And the last one is, how can people get in touch with you, or what is your preferred way of getting connected?
they can connect with me on Twitter is probably the best way, actually. Pardon me, I've got a relatively unusual surname, so I don't think there are many other Seb Belos around.
What is your username?
It's at Seb Belo, yeah.
So. Perfect. Okay, that is it, really. So thank you so much, Seb.
That's right. Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it. So it is bye for now until our next episode of Impact Leaders. And God bless you all. Please do remember to check our sponsors' websites for upcoming events. Thank you.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.